You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 23 of a series in the books of 1st and 2nd Kings. 2nd Kings chapter 11, verse 1. Now, when Athaliah, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she arose and destroyed all the royal family. But Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, and stole him away from among the king's sons who were being put to death, and she put him and his nurse in a bedroom. Thus they hid him from Athaliah so that he was not put to death, and he remained with her for 6 years hidden in the house of the Lord while Athaliah reigned over the land. But in the 7th year Jehoiada sent and brought the captains of the Karaites and of the guards, and had them come to him in the house of the Lord. And he made a covenant with them, and put them under oath in the house of the Lord, and he showed them the king's son. And he commanded them, "This is the thing that you shall do: 1/3 of you, those who come off duty on the Sabbath and guard the king's house, another third being at the gate Sir, and a third at the gate behind the guards, shall guard the palace. And the two divisions of you which come on duty in force on the Sabbath and guard the house of the Lord on behalf of the king shall surround the king, each with his weapons in his hand. And whoever approaches the ranks is to be put to death, but be with the king when he goes out and when he comes in." The captains did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded, and they each brought his men who were to go off duty on the Sabbath, with those who were to come on duty on the Sabbath, and came to Jehoiada the priest. And the priest gave to the captains the spears and shields that had been King David's, which were in the house of the Lord. And the guards stood, every man with his weapons in his hand, from the south side of the house to the north side of the house, round the altar and the house on behalf of the king. Then he brought out the king's son and put the crown on him and gave him the testimony. And they proclaimed him king, and anointed him, and they clapped their hands and said, "Long live the king!" When Athaliah heard the noise of the guard and of the people, she went into the house of the Lord to the people. And when she looked, there was the king standing by the pillar, according to the custom, and the captains and the trumpeters beside the king and all the people of the land rejoicing and blowing trumpets. And Athaliah tore her clothes and cried, "Treason! Treason!" Then Jehoiada the priest commanded the captains who were set over the army, "Bring her out between the ranks, and put to death with the sword anyone who follows her." For the priest said, "Let her not be put to death in the house of the Lord." So they laid hands on her, and she went through the horse's entrance to the king's house, and there she was put to death. And Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people, and that they should be the Lord's people, and also between the king and the people. Then all the people of the land went to the house of Baal and tore it down, his altars and his images they broke in pieces, and they killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars, and the priest posted watchmen over the house of the Lord. And he took the captains, the Karaites, the guards, and all the people of the land, and they brought the king down from the house of the Lord, marching through the gate of the guards to the king's house. And he took his seat on the throne of the kings. So all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet after Athaliah had been put to death with the sword at the king's house. Jehoash was 7 years old when he began to reign. We'll pause our reading there at the end of 2 Kings chapter 11. Now, in the previous episode, we saw how there was a decisive end to the dynasty of Omri that Ahab was part of in the northern kingdom of Israel. Jehu was the agent of that. There was a mass slaughtering of descendants of Ahab, a purging of the land from Baal worship. Although Jehu did not lead the people in absolute faithfulness to Yahweh, he retained the worship of the golden calves that Jeroboam had set up. But as I mentioned at the end of the last episode, that is not quite the end of the story of Ahab's family, because Athaliah, who is the daughter of Ahab and Jezebel, is the queen mother in the southern kingdom of Judah. So she had married into the royal family of Judah. She married King Jehoram, who was the 5th king of Judah, the son of Jehoshaphat. And she was influential in the Southern Kingdom in bringing Baal worship even in to Judah, as we see in this chapter. But her son Ahaziah, of course, was killed. He was killed at the same time by Jehu as Joram, who was the last king in the Omride dynasty in the Northern Kingdom. So Athaliah is the queen mother, and queen mother is a position of some influence and power. She had significant influence in the court, may have been involved in ruling, particularly if her son was away on a campaign, as he had been at the time of his death. And when she discovered that her son was dead, she took decisive action and she slaughters the royal family. Now, that's horrific enough as we think about it, because this includes, of course, people who she has treated as in-laws. It includes even descendants of her own. In verse 2, it says, Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, sister of Ahaziah, took Joash, the son of Ahaziah. In other words, her own grandson, Joram, would have been, or rather Joash, would have been killed by her if she'd been able to get him. And that seems drastic and dramatic. Why is Athaliah so determined to do this? Well, of course, on one level, she may be intensely angry about what has happened to her family in the Northern Kingdom. This may be retaliation of a sort. But at the same time, she's bound to be quite afraid that her position is now vulnerable. There's going to be a backlash and she herself might be removed. And so she takes a decisive action. But again, we shouldn't just read this as a historic event. This family that she's slaughtering is the royal family of Judah, the descendants of David. Had she been successful, then she would have annihilated the line of King David. Now, of course, God would not have allowed that to happen. It is interesting in this chapter that we don't read of God speaking or acting, but it's very clear that God is at work behind the scenes, as he always is in history, including in the history of Judah and Israel. And through Jehosheba, the daughter of King Joram, who is the sister of Ahaziah, in other words, probably a daughter of Athaliah, although it's possible, of course, that Joram had more than one wife. But she takes Joash, who's the son of Ahaziah, in other words, the grandson of Athaliah, steals him away from among the king's sons who were being put to death. So snatched in a way from the face of death, and she puts him with his wet nurse in a bedroom and hides him from Athaliah. They find sanctuary for him in the temple, in the house of the Lord, for 6 years. So there's a 6 year interregnum whenever it's Queen Athaliah, who is not an Israelite, or at least not a purebred Israelite. Her father Ahab was an Israelite. Her mother was, of course, Jezebel from Sidon, from Phoenicia. She reigns over the land. But this is really a dramatic rescue in a sense. This is the line of David and therefore the line of the Messiah being rescued by a woman who we know very little about, Jehosheba. It's not the first time and it's not the last time that God's family line will be preserved in a dramatic way. In the book of Genesis, Judah, who's the ancestor of the Lord Jesus and of David, is rescued by his brother Joseph in Egypt. In the New Testament, of course, Jesus, the son of Mary, the son of God, is rescued by his adoptive father, Joseph, in Egypt. But here it is the woman, Jehosheba, who rescues her nephew and ensures that he is not killed. And presumably his mother was killed, certainly his siblings were. But in the seventh year, Jehoiada, another character who comes on the scene here, takes action. And Jehoiada is a priest and he takes action. Some Jewish traditions suggest that he was married to Jehosheba, but certainly the two of them were acting together, a princess and a priest. And of course, this is significant. Now, the priesthood is rescuing the royal line. Jehoiada sends and brings the captains of the Karaites and of the guards and has them come to the temple, to the house of the Lord. The Karaites, of course, being a special group of warriors, possibly mercenaries from other nations, possibly connected to the Kerethites or Cherethites who served King David, but we're not entirely sure, but they were certainly a group of soldiers who were involved as guards of the temple. And Jehoiada summons these elite guards and he makes a covenant with them. Verse 4, notice the covenant language that runs through this chapter. He makes a covenant with them. It's the first of three times we'll read about covenants or testimonies in this chapter. He puts them under an oath and he reveals to them the king's son. It's a bold move. It's a risky move. But of course, he first of all puts them under covenant, an oath, and he tells them what to do to bring about a coup d'etat. And it's carefully planned. It's carefully thought through as to how they will guard the palace and the king's house. Which is, of course, where Athaliah is. So they're going to surround her so that she can't respond. They're going to surround the temple as well. And the priest gives them spears and shields. Verse 10 says that it had been King David's, which had been stored in the temple. Again, there's a great significance in this. This is the restoration of the Davidic dynasty. And these weapons that were associated with David himself are the sign of that. They proclaim him as king, and Athaliah, as we might expect, responds by crying treason, but she is executed and the temple of Baal is pulled down and Matan, the priest of Baal, is killed. Now, I said that there were three mentions of covenant language. The first is the covenant that is made between the priest Jehoiada and the guards. The second is when the king is put on the throne or given the crown. Verse 12, it says the king's son was brought out and the crown was put on him and he gave him the testimony. That word also means covenant. It probably refers to some kind of covenant that the king was making to rule well and to rule faithfully. But it's almost certainly connected with the language of Deuteronomy 17 that talked about what a king ought to be when the Israelites established a king. And it's connected to with the whole idea of God's covenant with the nation of Israel. So this, the sense here is that this will be a king who, as all kings were intended to do in Israel, was reigning under the authority of God. So here is a king in David's line ruling in the covenant that God had made with Israel and with his forefather David. So there's a combination of things going on here. The crown is put on his head. The people proclaim him king. He's anointed, of course, symbolic of the presence of God's Spirit. But also the testimony is there. This is done properly. This is a restoration. But the third mention of covenant comes later on in the chapter, in verse 17, after Athaliah has been led away and put to death, executed, Jehoiada, it says, made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people that they should be the Lord's people, and also between the king and the people. There may be one covenant here that encompasses these three parties, or two covenants, one between the Lord and the people and one between the king and the people. But whichever it is, this is clearly tying together the king, the people, and the Lord, as of course God had intended. God made his covenant with the nation of Israel in the time of David. God made his covenant with David and said that David would always have a descendant on the throne. And here that covenant is being renewed, restored afresh. It's a wonderful restoration of the centrality of God as the ruler of his people and of the king as a servant of God under the authority of God, covenanted to God, bound to him and bound to the people, the king, a servant of the people. And then, of course, Baal worship is eliminated in the southern kingdom of Judah. There's quite a contrast between this chapter and what we read in the preceding chapters in the northern kingdom. There was a very bloody coup by by an outsider, Jehu, who, yes, was used by God to get rid of the dynasty of Omri, to get rid of the family of Ahab, but he does it in a most bloody way. Here in the southern kingdom, it's Athaliah who acts in that bloody way of trying to eliminate the family of David. But the actual restoration of the Davidic dynasty is done in a very peaceable way. It's done in an orderly fashion. Only those who are guilty and only those who are leading, i.e. Athaliah and Matan, are put to death. And so this is also symbolic or representative of the nature of God's rule and the nature of the rule of God through a king in David's line. Order, peaceability, justice, righteousness, and devotion to God. And then we're told at the very end of the chapter that Jehoash was 7 years old when he began to reign, or Joash as he's also known. Let's read on then in 2 Kings chapter 12, verse 1. In the seventh year of Jehu, Jehoash began to reign, and he reigned for 40 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Zibiah of Beersheba. And Jehoash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all his days, because Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Nevertheless, the high places were not taken away. The people continued to sacrifice and make offerings on the high places. Jehoash said to the priests, "All the money of the holy things that is brought into the house of the Lord, the money for which each man is assessed, the money from the assessment of persons, and the money that a man's heart prompts him to bring into the house of the Lord, let the priests take, each from his donor, and let them repair the house wherever any need of repairs is discovered." But by the 23rd year of King Jehoash, the priests had made no repairs on the house. Therefore King Jehoash summoned Jehoiada the priest and the other priests and said to them, "Why are you not repairing the house? Now therefore take no more money from your donors, but hand it over for the repair of the house." So the priests agreed that they should take no more money from the people and that they should not repair the house. Then Jehoiada the priest took a chest and bored a hole in the lid of it and set it beside the altar on the right side as one entered the house of the Lord. And the priests who guarded the threshold put in it all the money that was brought into the house of the Lord. And whenever they saw that there was much money in the chest, the king's secretary and the high priest came up, and they bagged and counted the money that was found in the house of the Lord. Then they would give the money that was weighed out into the hands of the workmen who had the oversight of the house of the Lord, and they paid it out to the carpenters and the builders who worked on the house of the Lord, and to the masons and the stonecutters, as well as to buy timber and quarried stone for making repairs on the house of the Lord, and for any outlay for the repairs of the house. But there were not made for the house of the Lord basins of silver, snuffers, bowls, trumpets, or any vessels of gold or of silver from the money that was brought into the house of the Lord, for that was given to the workmen who were repairing the house of the Lord with it. And they did not ask an accounting from the men into whose hand they delivered the money to pay out to the workmen, for they dealt honestly. The money from the guilt offerings and the money from the sin offering was not brought into the house of the Lord. It belonged to the priests. At that time, Hazael, king of Syria, went up and fought against Gath and took it. But when Hazael set his face to go up against Jerusalem, Jehoash, king of Judah, took all the sacred gifts that Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah, his fathers, the kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred gifts, and all the gold that was found in the treasuries of the house of the Lord and of the king's house, and sent these to Hazael, king of Syria. Then Hazael went away from Jerusalem. Now the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? His servants arose and made a conspiracy and struck down Joash in the house of Millo on the way that goes down to Silla. It was Jozachar the son of Shimeath and Jehozabad the son of Shomer, his servants, who struck him down so that he died, and they buried him with his fathers in the city of David, and Amaziah his son reigned in his place. We'll pause our reading there at the end of 2 Kings chapter 20. Or rather chapter 12, we haven't quite got that far yet. Now, this chapter gives us some more insight into the reign of Jehoash, or Joash, specifically the repairs to the temple. He is dedicated to the worship of God. He's a godly king, and so he wants the temple to be repaired. But of course, the priests are ineffective. We don't know why. We shouldn't jump to conclusions. It doesn't necessarily mean that they were keeping the money that was being given for repairs, but they certainly weren't enacting it. Maybe they didn't have the skills administratively. But Jehoash comes up with an alternative solution, and he makes sure that the money gets to the supervisors who can make the work happen. Those supervisors are described as honest people. And we have double accounting as well. We're told in some detail of how the money was counted out and bagged by two people, not just by one. The king's secretary and the high priest did it together. So in many ways, this is a model example to us of probity and transparency in terms of accounting, which is a wise, wise lesson for us to learn in any form of Christian ministry, to have transparency and accountability, particularly where money is involved. But we also read then about Hazael. He hasn't gone away. He continues to be a scourge to the people of Israel, as he has been in the northern kingdom. He now creates difficulties for the southern kingdom. He conquers Gath, one of the cities of the Philistines, to the west of the territory of Judah, the kingdom of Judah. And Jehoash, rightly or wrongly, decides to pay him off. He gives him substantial amounts of money belonging to the royal family and also to the temple. And this is the beginning of decline. We've seen territorial decline of the northern kingdom, and the Aramaeans had snapped away the land to the east of the Jordan. And here we're seeing economic decline of the southern kingdom. But Joash himself is a godly king, but his ending is in assassination. He's killed by some of his servants, but significantly it's his son who becomes king. This is not the only assassination, as we'll see in this family line, but thankfully when Athaliah was removed and Joash was restored, the Davidic dynasty was restored, the southern kingdom retained a Davidic king throughout the generations, and the line of David was sustained. Let's read on then into chapter 13 of 2 Kings. In the 23rd year of Joash, the son of Ahaziah, king of Judah, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, began to reign over Israel in Samaria, and he reigned for 17 years. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. He did not depart from them. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them continually into the hand of Hazael, king of Syria, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael. Then Jehoahaz sought the favour of the Lord, and the Lord listened to him, for he saw the oppression of Israel, how the king of Syria oppressed them. Therefore the Lord gave Israel a saviour, so that they escaped from the hand of the Syrians, and the people of Israel lived in their homes as formerly. Nevertheless, they did not depart from the sins of the house of Jeroboam, which he made Israel to sin, but walked in them, and the Asherah also remained in Samaria. For there was not left to Jehoahaz an army of more than 50 horsemen, and 10 chariots, and 10,000 footmen, for the king of Syria had destroyed them and made them like the dust at threshing. Now the rest of the acts of Jehoahaz, and all that he did, and his might, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? So Jehoahaz slept with his fathers, and they buried him in Samaria, and Joash, his son, reigned in his place. In the 37th year of Joash, king of Judah, Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, began to reign over Israel in Samaria. And he reigned for 16 years. He also did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin, but he walked in them. Now the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, and the might with which he fought against Amaziah, king of Judah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Israel? So Joash slept with his fathers, and Jeroboam sat on his throne, and Joash was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel. We'll pause our reading there after verse 13 of 2 Kings 13. We're seeing here the succession of kings that was familiar from earlier on before it was interrupted by the narratives of Elijah and Elisha, the prophets. But we're seeing the continued decline of the northern kingdom under the reign of Jehoahaz, and how Hazael and his son Ben-Hadad were able to continually harry the northern kingdom and take away land, although God also gives them a saviour and delivers them at a point whenever the army is so weak in the northern kingdom. But again, the kings of the northern kingdom continue to do what is evil in the sight of God, following the worship, the system of worship that Jeroboam had set up. And that's true with the son of Jehoahaz, who is called Joash or Jehoash. Again, confusing, because we have two kings, just as we did before with Jehoram's. We have two kings here, one in the north, one in the south, both called Joash, whose reigns overlap. But let's read the rest of 2 Kings 13. Now when Elisha had fallen sick with the illness of which he was to die, Joash, king of Israel, went down to him and wept before him, crying, my father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen. And Elisha said to him, take a bow and arrows. So he took a bow and arrows. Then he said to the king of Israel, draw the bow, and he drew it. And Elisha laid his hands on the king's hands. And he said, open the window eastwards. And he opened it. Then Elisha said, shoot, and he shot. And he said, the Lord's arrow of victory, the arrow of victory over Syria, for you shall fight the Syrians in Aphek until you have made an end of them. And he said, take the arrows. And he took them, and he said to the king of Israel, strike the ground with them. And he struck three times and stopped. Then the man of God was angry with him and said, you should have struck five or six times. Then you would have struck down Syria until you had made an end of it. But now you will strike down Syria only three times. So Elisha died, and they buried him. Now bands of Moabites used to invade the land in the spring of the year. And as a man was being buried, behold, a marauding band was seen. And the man was thrown into the grave of Elisha. And as soon as the man touched the bones of Elisha, he revived and stood on his feet. Now Hazael, king of Syria, oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoahaz. But the Lord was gracious to them and had compassion on them. And he turned towards them because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and would not destroy them, nor has he cast them off from his presence until now. When Hazael, king of Syria, died, Ben-Hadad, his son, became king in his place. Then Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, took again from Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, the cities that had been taken from Jehoahaz, his father, in war. Three times Joash defeated him, and he recovered the cities of Israel. Now, as we reach the end of 2 Kings 13, we've reached the end of the life of Elisha, and we see these remarkable miracles even at the very end of Elisha's life. Elisha is already sick with a terminal illness. Joash is distressed. Kind of tragic, isn't it? A bit late for the kings of Israel to appreciate the presence of such servants of God. Elisha enacts this little enacted parable of the arrows and invites him to strike the ground with them. And well, it's always hard to know in these situations, isn't it, what would have happened if Joash had struck the ground more times? Would he really have had a permanent victory over Syria? Or did God foreknow this and therefore give this sign to Elisha? But he only strikes the ground three times. And sure enough, as we read at the end of the chapter, that's the number of victories that he's given over Syria. So there is a temporary reprieve here. But notice that that reprieve of the loss of territory, in the recovery of cities by Joash, the defeats that he inflicts on Ben-Hadad, it is framed in the context of God's grace. Verse 23, the Lord Yahweh was gracious to Israel and had compassion on them because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He has not cast them off. God did not forget his covenant. He didn't forget his people. He continued to bless them despite their repeated sinfulness. And that blessing is of the powerful and dramatic nature, so much so that even when Elisha, his servant, is dead, and buried. The man who is thrown into the grave of Elisha stands on his feet, is restored to life, a sign of God's favour, as so often in the ministry of Elisha, a sign of his favour in the face of the marauding bands of Moabites who invaded the land in the spring. But Israel is weakened, but God has not forgotten his promise. God remains gracious. God remains generous. God continues to have a purpose for his people. God will bring blessing. So two very different pictures. In the southern kingdom, we have the godly king, Joash, who is saved from the murderous intent of Athaliah. In the northern kingdom, we have the family of Jehu, who had purged the northern kingdom from Baal worship, and we have God's favour towards them. We have the end of the life of Elisha, the passing of that age of these two powerful miracle-working prophets, and we're going to see as we move further on into Kings, continued decline. There's a temporary reprieve for the northern kingdom, but the writing is on the wall, so to speak. The end will come.